Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
Today's podcast is focused on the art and the science of using prescribed fire to improve grassland habitat for wildlife. Joining me to co-host this episode is Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's fire expert and a very good friend of mine, Ben Wheeler. And joining us for today's conversation, our featured guest is Maura O'Connor. Maura is a journalist and the author of 3 books. And today we'll be talking about her brand new book called Ignition, with the subtitle Lighting Fires in a Burning World. The following is an excerpt from the book's description. Ignition is a work of on-the-ground reporting into the science of and cultural ideas around wildfires and fire management that challenges the ethos of the conservation movement, offering a hopeful vision of the connection between humans and our environment. So that's what we got on tap for y'all today: prescribed fire, wildfires, and ignition. Joining me, as I mentioned, is his return to the podcast since we were on the Rooster Road trip together, Ben Wheeler. Ben, thank you for joining me.
Bob, my good friend, it's always good to be with you.
For our listeners that don't know you, Ben, tell us a little bit about where you're from and what you do for the organization.
Yeah, so I live here in Nebraska. I'm a wildlife biologist with Pheasants Forever. I've been here for 16 years now. Working in the central part of the state. I grew up in Indiana, Northeast Indiana. It would be, if you're familiar with Indiana, 90 miles southeast of the world's largest egg in Mentone, Indiana.
I was wondering when you were going to drop the Easter egg nugget of facts, and there it is.
Yeah, 60 miles northeast of the world's largest ball of paint in Alexandria, Indiana. So That's my home stomping grounds, where I grew up, did my undergraduate work there in Indiana, did my grad work in western Kansas at Fort Hays, and have been up here in Nebraska for 16 years now.
16 years. So you and I, we've been with the organization for quite a while.
Yep. I'm still getting a paycheck. I guess they're not done with me yet.
And for listeners who've listened to many of our episodes, know that Ben and I are good friends. Ben often comes to grouse camp up in northern Wisconsin with me, and we've shared a lot of good times together. And this episode was Ben's concept. So I'll let you introduce our featured guest, Ben, because you know Maura here a little bit better than I do at this point.
Yeah, so it is my great, great pleasure and privilege to introduce my dear friend Maura. We met each other on a fire training event that we hold here in central Nebraska called the Loop Trex, T-R-E-X. And that's an acronym. It's not just an endearing green dinosaur with short arms. It stands for Training Exchange. And a few years ago, I'm trying to remember the first year you came, Maura. It might have been, was it 2021?
I think it was. It was spring 2021, and then 2022, the next spring. And then it was canceled last year, and now it's 2024. Or not canceled, sorry, but postponed.
Yeah. So Maura, I got this email from her, and our training exchange is an event where we invite wildland firefighters from all over the country, all over the world, to join us in Nebraska to train on a live fire experience. These are qualified firefighters. They are looking to get additional training to boost their boost their qualifications on the fire line. And so in the professional fire world, in order to move up that ladder, you have to, it's almost like having a scout book. You have these different things that you have to do and boxes you have to check to move up that ladder on the fire line. And so we acknowledge that, oh my goodness, we have this landscape that needs fire and we have professional firefighters that need to burn. Why don't they do it here? And so that was the genesis of the Loop Treks program many, many years ago, back in 2009, I think was our first event. That's when we organized. Our first event was 2010. But what we noticed was we are in a landscape where we're getting fire on the ground with our local landownership. This is private land here in Nebraska. And our local landowners are doing good work. They began using fire after 100, 150 years of fire exclusion. But they were doing it at a scale of 100 to 150 acres at a time. And at that time, the Nebraska Forest Service was their calculations were saying we're losing 40,000 acres of grassland to full canopy juniper invasion annually. And, you know, it, every year, 40,000 acres lost. And so what we realized right then is, oh, my goodness, these good 15, 20, 30 acre fires at a pop, we're just not going to do it. And so we pulled this event together to add large scale capacity to our landscape. Let's pull these guys in for their training, but with local ecological benefits here on a real scale for things like prairie chickens that need a lot of space. So that was the genesis of it. We had a guy in my office came and dropped a map on my desk back in 2009. And he was formerly with the Nature Conservancy. His name's John Ortman. And he said, hey, I've been thinking about this concept for large scale fires from one road to the next. And here's an idea I had up in this area. And he kind of left it on my desk for me to look at. And he went back to his desk and I stood there kind of staring at it for 5 or 10 minutes, and I walked back to his desk and I said, John, we can't not do this. We have to do this. I mean, something where we can impact thousands of acres at a pop. We have to at least try. And now it's 2024, years later. That program, we've impacted 30,000 acres just in central Nebraska, and it's been wonderful. So moving forward to 2021, I get this email from Maura, who's interested in looking into more about fires. She says, hi, I'm a journalist. I'm a freelance journalist. I'm from New York, which incidentally is home to the world's largest kaleidoscope and the world's largest pancake griddle. Just to drop that in.
Thank you.
But she said, I'm interested.
And a very big apple.
And a big apple. Yeah. So she said, I'm looking at getting some fire experience. I have this assignment that I'm doing for a book. And she was referred to our program, our Loop Treks program, as a good starting point. But Maura, that's the first email I got from you. Would you like to kind of introduce yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of, looking back on it, funny that I ended up going to Nebraska, and that's where I had one of like my first sort of formative and significant exposures to fire. Nebraska wasn't really on my radar as a place when I came up with this book idea of looking at wildfires and intentionally lit fires by people in North America, I wasn't even really aware of Nebraska being a place where that happens. And so, yeah, but in retrospect, I'm so fortunate that it was one of the first places that I went. I had this book idea and I wanted to go and look at people who light fires on purpose for ecological benefit. And somebody was like, well, there's this training event that happens in a place called Ord, Nebraska. And when I wrote to you, Ben, at that time, I don't think I even had like a pair of fire boots. I don't think I had done my pack test, which is like the required physical test for, you know, to make sure you can sort of hack it on the fire line and, you know, carry around this big backpack for a few miles. And so when you said yes, I remember, like, come on out, which was so generous. I think I was like, oh man, I better get all of this gear and like do this pack test and like make sure I can actually, you know, keep up when I'm out there. So I just arrived out in Nebraska really kind of not knowing very much. And it was just so eye-opening to see what you guys were doing out there. And then also just be invited to participate in such a hands-on, you know, just become someone on the crew. And so that really affected my understanding of fire, of prairie ecosystems, and also just sort of is what gave me the fire bug and then wanting to just keep doing more and more.
So I want to come back to your reaction about the fire and that experience, but I want tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're from, like your back. You've written some interesting books, and I'm curious about your overall background, and then maybe you can lead us into how you got the idea for this book.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm a journalist, so I kind of started out making my bread and butter as like a newspaper journalist in New York, and I would use money that I made being what's called a stringer, you reporting for newspapers like the New York Post or the Wall Street Journal, to then travel abroad and do sort of longer nonfiction reporting about conflicts and war and humanitarian issues, and also a lot of environmental stories about conservation, development aid. And so I managed to sort of travel a lot. I went to places like Afghanistan and Africa and Haiti. And one of the places that I went to also is Australia. And that's kind of where I first got exposed to fire. You know, I was in Australia and saw recently burned ground. And somebody explained to me that that had been intentionally done. And that was just sort of very new to me, that concept of ecologically beneficial fire. So that's where I first got exposed to fire, is just from reporting abroad. And I guess I kind of call myself a science journalist. I report on more than science, but I really love science stories. I really love stories that sort of look at the ethics around conservation and the values that are at work around, you know, how people preserve or interact with natural environments, but really always trying to kind of, I think, subvert people's understandings of what that looks like and what that can mean. You know, I don't like writing sad, dismal stories about how we're losing nature every day. And, you know, if we don't do X, then the world is going to end. Like, that kind of, to me, is not a very good story. And I'm really interested in, like, meeting people on the ground and really kind of, if I can, going to a few extra deep levels of understanding how we relate to natural places and how we preserve them for the future.
So then tying that into the loop tracks, Maura had at that point a couple books under her belt, Resurrection Science and then Wayfinding, which at that time, I believe, had not been out very long. So when she emailed me, I took a quick look at those books, that work that she had done, and it was very evident right away, she's a storyteller. Mm-hmm. And these the people that have that gift for immaculate storytelling, we need them. We need them in the conservation space of this world.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I did my own research, and obviously it was focused on Ignition, more as your current book, and Prescribed Fire. But, you know, the two other books, Resurrection Science and Wayfinding, I mean, I found myself getting sucked into Resurrection Science. That just really piqued my interest. I was like, no, I got to study for fire. I got to study fire. But give me a little bit of that. In particular, grabbed my attention. Give me a little soundbite for what that book is all about.
Yeah, that book, I'm not surprised that it grabbed your attention being involved in wildlife,
yeah.
you know, habitat, conservation issues and such. I mean, that book arose out of this story that I wrote about this very small population of toads that had originated from like a single waterfall in Tanzania and had literally been helicoptered out of this gorge when this disease broke out that was going to threaten their survival. And also the World Bank was trying to fund a dam there. So there was a very interesting sort of conflict of interest between providing electricity to like a third of Tanzania's population and trying to preserve these very rare frogs. And so they had these frogs in the Bronx at the zoo there, and I went and visited them. And it just sort of, the story led me on this path to looking at other populations of animals, like very, very small populations of animals, and how we intervene to quote unquote save them using technology and, you know, whether it's putting them in zoos or artificial insemination. Like, it's raised all of these really interesting questions to me about, like, what are we doing here when we talk about saving an almost extinct species? And if we're not preserving the landscapes that these species live and are integral to, what is left? And are these just zoo specimens? And so it ended up bringing me to look at really different types of animals. I looked at like this desert pupfish in New Mexico. I looked at this crow in Hawaii. I went to Kenya and got to like stand next to four of the last four remaining northern white rhinoceroses in the world. There's only two now. And that was a cool trip because I got to bring my 7-month-old son with me, and I've got pictures of him next to the rhinos. And, you know, but what does that mean? And what would it have really taken to save those rhinos? And what became clear to me over reporting that book is like, you can have northern white rhinos in a zoo, perhaps, but like the landscape that they came from is still totally compromised by war, poverty. And so we haven't really solved the problem,
yeah.
you know, by quote unquote saving that species.
Fascinating, fascinating concept for a book. I'm going to read that. We're probably going to have you back on. But it does cool. speak to a really interesting connection in it. In my worldview, to prescribe fire, which I think is how it connects Ben to prescribe fire on the landscape. You bring up prairie chickens, whether it's lesser, greater, sharptails, you know, these species that lesser prairie chicken, for instance, that are on the edge. The individual birds are not, shouldn't be the focal point. The focal point should be the landscape, and that's where prescribed fire comes in. So I want to transition here, Ben, just for folks, and I'm assuming that our listening audience of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever members have a basic understanding of the value of prescribed fire, but I should never make assumptions. So let's kind of provide the foundation of why prescribed fire is so critically important to an organization like ours, built on grassland habitats for upland birds.
Yeah, you know, Maura mentioned some conservation issues that we have around the country, around the world, that are quite challenging. And we're really fortunate here in Nebraska that that it's not so challenging, at least politically, socially. We have this unique opportunity in Nebraska where the things that we want to do for upland birds is also beneficial to other land use practices like livestock raising.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we deal with here, and you guys have talked about this on your podcast before, is brush encroachment into our grasslands, into our prairies. And this isn't a unique issue in Nebraska. It's kind of all over the country. And so if we look at why people are burning here in the Great Plains. We'll take that for example. Probably the most frequent primary objectives for fire and other places too is for that brush management, is to set back that encroachment of woody species coming into prairies, or in some cases, the understories of forests too. Mm-hmm. And this makes sense. So as an example, my home here in Valley County, in 2022, according to the University of Nebraska, some research they've done, we had a loss of over 4,000 tons of forage in grasses due to tree encroachment. That's just 1 year. So that equates, in this county, a loss of forage for about 2,000 cows. So our carrying capacity for livestock goes down when these trees come in. Grass just doesn't grow under the trees that we have. And here in Nebraska, our tree, like many other places that we're dealing with, is eastern red cedar, which is a juniper. It's not actually a cedar. So many people listening might not be a livestock producer. So to give you a frame of reference, each cow of those 2,000s equals about 700 pounds of beef. So if you have 2,000 cows and 700 pounds of beef, that's about 1.5 million pounds of beef. That's 6 million quarter pounders at McDonald's. Hmm. I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot of sandwiches. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm imagining like a new conservation sign related to those old 2 billion burgers sold that you would see under the McDonald's sign. We might be able to do something with that. But playfulness aside, imagine the economic impacts of removing 6 million quarter pounders in sales from just one county that's home to only 4,000 people. I mean, that's a big deal. So to pull this into perspective for Pheasants Forever and upland bird conservation, traditionally we've been focused on grassland conservation as it relates to grassland conversion to agricultural development. You know, that's kind of been our bread and butter to this point. Mm-hmm. And specifically, we've targeted tearing out of grasslands for row crop production. And the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, has kind of been our flagship program that we stand behind. And it's widely considered to be one of the most successful grassland conservation programs in the history of the United States. So we just had some fresh research that came out of the University of Nebraska. I just heard of it last week at a meeting that's suggesting that in Nebraska, our prairie losses due to tree encroachment, so brush encroachment, are now basically at an equal loss to agriculture development.
Hmm.
Which is a big deal when you think about what we're focused on. Now, and this is largely due to just a lack of fire. Fire was the maintaining force in those grasslands, in those prairies to keep trees out. Now, interestingly, we have a really robust fire history ecologically here in the Great Plains. And though there were lightning-caused fires, and that's what a lot of people think of, many of the fires that we have had historically in Nebraska were purposefully set by indigenous peoples. And they use fire for a multitude of reasons. You know, primarily in the Great Plains, they use fire to stimulate forage for attracting bison. But they also use fire to hunt. They used it to procure other materials out in the prairie, for ceremony, for signaling, to cook, just to stay warm, and for warfare. And, you know, contrary to our primary objective for fire that we use in 2024, which is to treat trees, I have yet to find an example of American Indians on the central and northern Great Plains who used fire for the purpose of killing trees or to keep back woody encroachment. It's just really interesting to me. And I think we can take an important lesson from that. So, you know, right now, our use of fire with a management of focus for targeting, basically running away from what we don't want. Indigenous peoples were managing for what they wanted, and that's primarily for production of protein. So instead of, I think we need to maybe shift eventually into having a stronger vision for what it is that we want with our actions. Sometimes we just get so focused on negative woody targets that it seems like we miss those non-woody objectives: healthy grasses, nutrient recycling, crude protein content. And sometimes we get a little bit lost when we're so ultra focused on kind of that kill them all mentality for trees. We even see this in practice in the Great Plains. So one of the most challenging places that we have in getting fire on the land are healthy open grasslands with little woody plant encroachment. And in many cases, they don't feel a tree problem. And so they don't see a need for fire. And these are the places where we could have the greatest impact.
Hmm. So to bring in the quail element of our audience, we've talked about the importance of prescribed fire to bobwhite quail on this podcast a number of times. And as we prepared for this conversation, you know, you also asked Ben, bring up Herbert Stoddard, a quail as the firebird. And I want to be able to, weave that component in because you revere Stoddard and his teachings as well. So we connect the dots here with quail and parts of the Southeast for us.
Yeah. So Herbert Stoddard was a great man. He's deceased now, but he is famously referred to as giving the bobwhite quail the name Firebird, because he observed that fire and bobwhites were so obviously linked. He was born in Illinois, 1889. He's a key figure in early wildlife management. He was a contemporary of Leopold's. He published a 600-page exhaustive book, Bobwhite Quail, Its Habitats, Preservation, and Increase, I think is what the subtitle was. And that was back in 1931. If you can find that book for under $150, grab it. Grab it. It's a steal. It's hard. They're getting harder to find.
And email also, Ben Wheeler at bwheeler@pheasantsforever.org. You're collecting them, huh?
I'm collecting them, yeah. And he also helped co-found the Tall Timbers Research Station with the Komarek brothers in 1958. He did all of this as a high school dropout who was obsessed with taxidermy. He loved taxidermy. Now, if you thumb through that entire 600 pages of his bobwhite text looking for the term firebird, you won't find it. Hmm. It's not in there. That's in his autobiography, Memoirs of a Naturalist. And in the introduction of that book, George Sutton mentions taking a drive with Stoddard. This reminds me of the drive you took, Maura, in Australia. He's taking a drive with Herbert Stoddard, and they get to a point, and Herbert Stoddard points out to a lightning-struck longleaf pine. It's charred up and down the flank, and Herbert Stoddard points, and he says, "That's it. There you have it. That's nature's way of producing bobwhite habitat, this lightning strike that spread out." He said, that's it. So a few years ago, back in 2012, there was a famous paper in the fire world that was released. And it took several lines of evidence, and it mapped out historical fire intervals for the United States prior to 1850. So this is pre-Industrial Revolution. So a fire interval is how often historically a fire would have moved through an ecosystem. And this map that they produced is painted with many colors, from red and orange, meaning a frequent fire interval of at least every 8 or 10 years. And it cools off to blue and purple colors, meaning less frequent, but still every 20 to 50 years in those places. And what's really revealing is that on this map, there is not a place in the United States where there's no color. Every ecosystem, and then all of the associative wildlife that call those ecosystems home, had fire as an elemental process in the development of those ecosystems. So to bring this back to upland birds, and specifically to quail a little bit, we're familiar with quail being called the firebird. Now, imagine where bobwhites exist in the U.S., and then take a peek at this map. And what color do you see? It's red, it's orange, it's really frequent fire. So every 4 or 5 years. So let's take it a step further. Imagine any of the 6 species of quail that we have here in the United States. And you've seen this map, Bob. I think I sent it to you.
You did, yep.
Imagine any of these 6 species. So bobwhite, scaled quail, gambels, merns, valley quail, mountain quail. And now look at the red and orange colors on the map and see how they correlate with the geographic ranges of all of our species of quail. There's no exceptions.
Yeah.
So if anything, this map takes Stoddard's claim of bobwhite being called the firebird and it extends it to all of our quail. Imagine now the ranges of our prairie grouse, prairie chickens, lesser prairie chickens, sharp-tailed grouse. That map is red, orange, a little bit of yellow, but we're still looking at a fire interval maintaining those habitats at least every 12 years and more often every 5 to 8. But you don't even have to stop there. Other grouse, ruffed grouse, spruce grouse, sage grouse also occupy those ecosystems that have a regularly occurring fire component. Big game as well, white-tailed deer, mule deer, pronghorn, elk, moose, wild turkeys. They all live in these ecosystems where fire helps massage, it helps maintain that habitat. So essentially, wherever you're at in the United States, if you look out your window, fire had a regular and important say in how that ecosystem was developed and maintained. And this isn't just a Great Plains phenomenon. Anywhere you're planning a hunt, fire was there. We have Pheasants Forever members representing every state in the country, and those places and ecosystems need fire. If anyone wants to take a look at this map, you can do a Google search. It's simple enough. Guyette, Guyette, it was in 2012, predicting fire frequency. You can take a look at that map yourself.
Go ahead, Maura.
I was going to say one of the things I learned about Stoddard's book when I was reporting my book was, and I just thought it was like a fascinating anecdote, is that the Forest Service hated Stoddard's chapter about fire so much that they made him rewrite it like 6 times before they would publish it. And the same year it was published, there was also this act passed in the United States that withheld federal funding from states that engaged in fire lighting practices in any kind of official sort of capacity. So you can see that, like, how against the stream Stoddard was in presenting these ecological facts that he had observed, you know, in northern Florida his whole life almost to the public, and how hard even his own employers and, you know, the National Landscape Management agencies were rejecting his message. And, you know, that's lingered for so long, that sort of bias against fire actually being able to serve this this ecological purpose. So it's just, you know, he really was doing something that was not looked upon favorably when he published that work.
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, any biologist today that we have on talking about bobwhite quail, it's like every 2 years, if we can get prescribed fire on a bobwhite quail landscape every 2 years, that's what really is going to have the response for the bird populations that's necessary for a healthy ecosystem. And that, but to Ben's point about this map, you know, like sharp-tailed grouse are also called the firebird, you know? I mean, there's all sorts of different upland birds that are named the firebird, and it is. So I just wanted to take a moment and just kind of link this all together on the importance of fire to the birds that we all chase with our pups around the Great Plains and the savannas of the Southeast and all the different places in the country. So we'll go back to Ord, Nebraska, and Maura, your first experience with the fire. So at this point, you know you're going to write a book about fire, but I'm assuming that this, right, because you went there with like getting this book process started. So take us through your mindset experiencing a fire for the first time, and then how it shaped the direction of where your book is headed from here. Because you mentioned a few minutes ago, you weren't really thinking about the prairies. You were thinking about the forests and wildfires when you came to this book concept. So take us from Nebraska forward.
Yeah, I think early on, when I started doing research for the book, which I absolutely did want to connect to the sort of wildfire crisis that we're seeing every summer, and not just in the Western United States, but around the world. So I wanted to understand the relationship between the wildfires that we're seeing that seem so extreme and catastrophic, and the fact that there's these traditions of fire lighting practices that for so long had been suppressed or and in some places lost completely. So I wanted to see how those two things relate to each other. And I definitely was thinking more along the lines of timber and forests. And I think that's because that's what dominates the news. So, but I realized that in order to kind of write this book, I was going to have to like get closer to fire. And the way to do that, I realized, was to sort of get the bare minimum qualifications as a wildland firefighter that would allow me to safely be on the fire line and not get in anybody's way. But I still kind of envisioned myself with like a notebook and a pen, like standing off to one side and like being like, oh, that's how that person, you know, holds a tool, and that's how an engine works, and sort of just, you know, being present, but purely in this role as like an observer, a journalist. And when I got the information about loop treks, I was sort of like a little bit skeptical. And I remember asking the guy, like, not is it cool, but more or less like, should I go? Like, is this cool? Should I go? And he's like, believe me, like, this is the best. Like, you couldn't go to a better place to see fires being lit. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to take his word for it. I really just didn't have any much more to go on except for like his reassurance that like it was going to be worth it. And so, yeah, when I showed up, it was really mind blowing to me. I think that year the goal was to burn, was it 4,000 acres, Ben? Is that, yeah. So like, I'm like driving down the road, you know, looking at this beautiful, but pretty barren, you know, like late winter landscape, and being like, 4,000 acres? Like, it just seemed inconceivable to me that we were going to set fire to 4,000 acres over like 2 weeks. So, you know, not in one day, but still, like, how is that even possible? And so what quickly ended up happening was that Ben gave me like a tool to use and put me on a crew. So there was no like standing off to one side with my notebook. Like, that wasn't happening. And getting really dirty and really tired really fast, just like being part of the crew, and then learning in a very, you know, technical fashion how it is that you can set fire to 4,000 acres, and, you know, what blacklining is, how to use a UTV, flappers, you know, all these things that were very new to me. And meeting the people, Ben included, who have that knowledge and that direct experience with fire, and can explain the connection between weather, topography, fire history, you know, fire behavior, humidity, like all of these variables that you have to really be thinking deeply about in order to predict and understand fire behavior. It was, the science behind it became so fascinating. And so, but I will say that one of the reasons why the prairie, I'm so happy that that was my first experience of intentional fire lighting and prescribed fire, is that I think the lighting fires in the prairie sort of like challenges a very basic assumption that we have about nature and how to conserve nature. And this idea that like the less people, the better, right, for a landscape, and like the way to save a place is to sort of limit the impact of people. And when you're in the prairie and when you start reading the fire history of the prairie, what is so amazing and evident is that people have had a role in maintaining that ecosystem, perhaps even expanding it and making it as big as it is by having a direct role to play in its maintenance. So it's not roping it off and leaving it alone. It's like directly engaging, observing, and maintaining. And so to me, I was just like, in the prairie, that was the place where that kind of hit me like a lightning bolt. Like, oh, it's not people are bad, nature is good and better left alone. It's like there's this relationship here And that relationship goes back many, many, many thousands of years. And here's a group of people who are trying to continue that.
So in your book highlights somewhat new terms for me. So as I'm reading through the, the intro, there's talk of paleobotany and ethnoecology, a cultural fire. So I think that's what you're getting to is, the human's relationship with these landscapes, and that fire takes on many different purposes. So paleobotany, what's that mean to our listeners?
I think that paleobotany is like the understanding or the science of like looking at plants in the deep, deep past, right? Like fossils of plants. And so in the book, I talk a little bit about that actually in New York State, where you look at some of these oldest fossilized forests that have ever been found, and they're like hundreds of millions of years old. And that's how people can look at some of the earliest trees on the planet, right? And by trees, I mean, some of these things are like little mosses, right? But they were the first that the earth had. So what's really interesting about that is when you get into fire science, you know that there has to be three elements present, right, in order for there to be combustion. And that's oxygen, fuel, and Ben, what's the third one?
Heat.
So when you look at like paleobotanists are studying, it's like, well, when was the first fire? And you needed that. You needed the fuel, right? Which are these like fossilized plants, these very early little trees or plants, and then oxygen. So the earth had to have a certain amount of oxygen present in the atmosphere. And then you had to have this heat source, an ignition source, which back then would more than likely a volcano or lightning or something. So it's just really interesting, I think, to go into the deep past and look at, the ecology of these ancient ecosystems and be like, oh, fire has always sort of been here. And this is a uniquely, as Steve Pine, the like fire historian says, this is a uniquely fiery planet. This doesn't happen in other places. And it's been here for longer than we have. And so, okay, well, then how have plants adapted to fire over the eons? And then you realize, wow, like the same way you guys are talking about, there's these quail species everywhere that are adapted to fire. It's like plant species everywhere, grasses everywhere that are adapted to fire. And it really shifts your perspective, right? Because I think we're just all so indoctrinated into this view that fire is bad. Fire kills trees. Fire kills,
Right.
And so that deep history changes that.
And there's so many, and you talk about this in your book, and we all, depending on what geography you live in, there's a different species that you connect with that can't release their seed unless there's fire. For me, I grew up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and you learn in school, it's like, it's jack pines. Jack pines need fire or else they won't reproduce. And there's so many different species of plants that are connected to that. The other terms I mentioned are somewhat tied together. I think they are anyways. Ethnoecology and cultural fire. So we've talked about through the conversation so far is how indigenous people have used fire throughout time to sort of manage for what they want. Is that what you're referencing in some of these terms as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the ethnoecology, it's like the sort of anthropological study of how like different people have interacted with the natural world through time, right? And so that could include how indigenous communities used fire or like used fire to produce certain plant types or ecotypes. And then the cultural fire is, I think, maybe slightly different in the sense that it's really specifically how do people use fire to cultural ends. So it might be more than just maintaining a certain type of plant species, but it might be for things like ceremony or basketry, food also and foraging, like creating, say, like nut orchards or something. Hmm. So the terms are definitely overlapping mm-hmm. in a big way. Mm. But I think cultural difference. Fire, there's some difference. I think cultural fire has been used more and more now because indigenous communities are saying, hey, for so long we've been told that we are not allowed to use this important tool. But if we don't, our culture cannot survive. And so really taking a stand for their own sovereignty and their own ability to use this tool that's been central to their culture for so long. And you see that happening in different places, but particularly Northern California, the Southwest. And, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think about, you know, for generations now, we've suppressed fire largely out of fear. At least this is my impression. And it feels like that's becoming greater and greater fear. As you talk about in the media, you see these wildfires, and general public's view is, well, fires lose control, and that's what leads to, you know, California burning down. And but it's actually, it's counterintuitive. It's the reverse of that, isn't it? In that we need fire on the landscape to actually prevent some of the wildfire that we see in media. Is that accurate, kind of breaking it down in super simple terms?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem is that we don't have a very good vocabulary around fire. So, you know, we say fire and like, what does that actually mean? And and what is most interesting to me is that fire really, what it looks like and how it behaves completely depends on the context. So if you have like a completely drought, pest ridden, overgrown forest in California, and, you know, someone throws a cigarette butt out their window in August on a windy day, like what type of fire are you going to create? And it is going to be a monster, and it is going to be terrifying, and it can cause immense pain and suffering and destruction. If you have, you know, a fire on a beautiful day in Nebraska in spring in Ord, and you're, you know, that fire is going to do maybe exactly what you want and create amazing ecological benefits. We kind of just lack a very broad vocabulary to be describing these different types of fire. And so one of the things I think is really important today is trying to thread this needle. On the one hand, we're seeing catastrophic fires that are really damaging, and we need to figure out what the solution. On the other hand, there's this other type of fire that we need to educate ourselves about and become very familiar with, because that's partly how we prevent those catastrophic fires.
Yeah, and you know, one, I think that's a great point, Maura, that we need to have a new vocabulary. But and we also, I feel like we identify certain places with a certain type of fire. And so a lot of times we think of California and we think about these destructive fires that are burning up homes. We see these air tankers that are dropping pink retardant all over a neighborhood. We hear about people whose lives are lost. And so we assign like a geography to fire in a very specific way, like Maura said, but there's good fires that happen in California too. And there's intentional fires that happen in California too. And so, and Maura's been out west on wildfire detail. I have too. One of the things we see there is with a lack of fire so long in a forest system, you know, if you don't burn it, that fuel is still there. And then next year, there's a little bit more. And then next year, there's a little bit more. And then next year, and if you do that for 150 years, you have so much fuel that when it actually does burn, it rips. And it's hard to control. It's hard to manage. It's super, super hot. It gets up into the upper canopy of these legacy sequoias and legacy redwoods, just pushing through and kind of being how they describe it, just it kind of destroys that place when the historical fire in those places would have kind of just swept through the understory at the ground level. And there wasn't that buildup of fire, or I'm sorry, that buildup of fuels to get it up into the tops of those trees. Those trees, there's some redwoods that have 2 foot bark, 2 foot thick, that protects it from the effects of fire. And so a fire at the ground level just kind of modestly moves around those trees. But then after 150 years of not cleaning that fuel up, that's when it races through, and we have some of the most significant fire problems that we've encountered. And it's not unique to California. It's becoming, like Morris said, a worldwide problem.
I would say one of the issues is that we sometimes today, and I say this for myself, like mainly, is we don't know what we're looking at. You know, so I can drive around central Nebraska and see all these trees and like be like, well, that's normal. Like, of course, there's some cedars here. Oh, this is beautiful. And you can go out west and you can go hiking through the forest and be like, wow, look at how dense this forest is. It must be very healthy. And so without a kind of historical understanding of the landscape and how people used to inhabit those places, how they used to be managed and stuff, you don't realize what you're looking at is a really sort of wildly overgrown, like eastern cedars that are just proliferating and wiping out, you know, diversity on the ground, or that you're walking through a forest that's like can't support deer, you know, is prone to drought and pests. And so it's almost like once you become a little bit educated and understand what you're looking at, you definitely can't unsee it. There's no way I could drive through central Nebraska now and see eastern red cedars and say, oh, isn't that pretty? Like now it gives me goosebumps. I'm like, oh man, this is awful. Yeah. You know? And that's just really important to have that like aesthetic shift, I think, where you know what you're looking at.
You know, another component here, and we haven't talked about it at all yet, is the science around using prescribed fire in mitigating climate change. And that's a big component of your book as well. Tell me a little bit about how, because you, again, it's, we're a visual species and we look at fire and all this smoke going into the atmosphere and it's like, this has got to be terrible for the climate. But used in the right way, it's a benefit for what we're trying to mitigate with climate change, isn't it?
Yeah, I think in multiple levels. So on the one hand, there's been studies done out in Yosemite where they've allowed or like sort of carefully managed lightning ignitions and allowed them to burn, and seen that the water retention in those places, even in drought years, is much higher just because there's less competition between trees. And, you know, we were socked in last June in New York City by the wildfires up in Canada, you know, and the sky was orange and picking up my kids and everybody's wearing masks again. I mean, it's crazy. And the emissions from those types of wildfires are just really significant. I mean, you're talking about potentially emitting the equivalent of like an entire country's carbon emissions in like, you know, a fire season. And so there's a huge detrimental value in these catastrophic wildfires blowing up. And what I've heard said, and I think makes a lot of sense, is like, if you don't like the smoke and you don't want to be socked in all summer during fire season, and you want to prevent these catastrophic emissions, light more fires, you know, light more frequent fires, but under controlled conditions.
You know, you brought up, more a moment ago, the connection with fire benefiting water. And I think that's also incongruent to people's expectation, you know. I think very specifically, Nebraska, Ogallala Aquifer, Eastern Red Cedars, you know, fire keeping Eastern Red Cedars pushed back in promoting prairie, you know, that actually benefits water quality, because eastern red cedars suck so much water out of the aquifer. It's not just one geography where that's true, correct?
Yeah, I mean, what you see in like New Mexico a lot is a sort of effort to reframe prescribed burning in terms of watershed protection. So, you know, you have an entire watershed that affects, say, the city of Santa Fe or Albuquerque, And when thinking about how to communicate with those, you know, citizens in those places about the need for prescribed fire, it's like less about preserving forests or the health of the forest, and more like, hey, if we don't burn somewhat frequently and manage this forest, we could have a wildfire through here that compromises the entire watershed for the city of Santa Fe and, you know, causes super destructive erosion and all sorts of problems for water quality. And so I think that's a really important reframing of the fire question. And, you know, like what you're saying about Eastern Red Cedars, another way I've heard it described is in Northern California, like there's just too many straws sucking out of the, you know, aquifers, the rivers. And just, it's interesting, you know, we think trees are good. Don't cut down trees, like, right? Like that's sort of the default, you would say, environmental position. And it's like, okay, let's think of trees as straws, right? And how does that change how we think about trees? It's like, no, not all trees are good. You know, we don't need this many. And actually that's like a historical aberration. That's not nature, some objective nature out there. You know, that's something we created through our fire suppression policies.
Right on. More on a general public perspective, like contacting elected officials, is that a relevant next step for people to advocate for prescribed burning?
I think it is. I mean, I think that could definitely be an appropriate and needed line of action. You know, when New Mexico had a prescribed burn that sort of reignited and resulted in the Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon fire, the New Mexico legislature tried to ban spring prescribed burns. And I think ultimately that the effort failed, but there are some more limitations. And, you know, part of it is recognizing that prescribed burning is 99%, you know, controlled and safe. Sometimes there are burns that escape control, but recognizing the question isn't like, what will happen if we burn? It's more like, what will happen if we don't burn? And sort of increasing our understanding and tolerance for prescribed fire is huge. And so, you know, in that case, I think contacting legislative members and saying, hey, I actually don't think we should be limiting prescribed burning, we need more of it, would have, you know, is hugely effective. I personally just feel that and want, like, every person who's interested to get their hands on a drip torch. I just think that if you can and you're just at all curious, just getting up close and seeing a fire and being close to a fire is really transformative, because so few of us are able to have those opportunities. And once you do, it just changes how you think about conservation and the health of our landscapes. And if you're not interested in, you know, getting your hands on a drip torch, like Ben said, there's a need for volunteers in all capacities. A friend of mine said, you know, man, we need someone to show up with muffins, you know, like we need someone with the drip torch and we need the person with the muffins. Like there's generally a role there and a sense of community of needing this community-wide effort. And so, you know, whether you're really gung-ho or not, like just sort of getting close in whatever capacity is possible is such a great thing. And educating oneself about your own landscape, your own backyard, and why it looks the way it does is just a huge part of it too.
Yeah, great. You know, so throughout this entire conversation, we've talked about all the positives of prescribed fire and fire for wildlife and habitat. And I don't want to be Pollyanna. Is there anything that, you know, we should be mindful of that are negative results of fire for wildlife?
Yeah, for sure. Sometimes that happens, and we see sometimes direct impacts of fire on animals, on individuals. Sometimes fire rolls through and it'll kill an individual. And often we understand this, we acknowledge this, and we assume that the greater benefits are going to be there in that habitat overall. But we have to be careful. So a story of this would be, you're familiar with the heath hen, right? Our prairie chicken that used to be out on the eastern side of the country. It's a subspecies of prairie chicken. It was along the Atlantic coast. And in fact, it's very plausible and probably likely that the centerpiece of the very first Thanksgiving dinner was a prairie chicken and not a turkey. Mm. Very likely. But we can never know for sure. But through some direct and indirect effects of colonization by Europeans, the heath hen was eventually extirpated on the mainland by 1870. And there was just a remnant population left on Martha's Vineyard. And this is also one of the first, Maura documented it in her book, it's also one of the first observation of encroaching brush following the absence of fire on the North American continent. So Maura mentions in her book in 1634, just 14 years after the famous Plymouth Rock landing, colonists were writing about encroaching brush from the lack of indigenous fire due to American Indian numbers decreasing from disease and likely hostility as well. And so the relationship between fire and brush and woody encroachment on this continent has now been realized for almost 400 years. Pulling that back to Martha's Vineyard, heath hens limited there. And if you're familiar with the late E.O. Wilson's theory of island biogeography, once an island loses its connection or seed source from a mainland or a primary population, all bets are off. Anything can happen. Hmm. And in the case of the heath hen, there was no mainland population left by 1870. It's just the island. And the closest relatives at that point were probably prairie chickens at least 1,000 miles away in Indiana. So scoot forward to May 12th, specific day, May 12th, 1916. There's 2,000 heath hens still alive on the plains of Martha's Vineyard. An 8-year-old Francis Hammerstrom, you probably recognize that name if you're familiar with prairie chickens in Wisconsin. She would later become famous for her work with her husband on prairie chickens in Wisconsin. And anybody who appreciates prairie grouse can't be thankful enough for their work in prairie chicken conservation. But she was participating on that day in Martha's Vineyard in a junior tennis tournament there on the island. Smoke began coming in and May 12th. So this is nesting season for prairie chickens. Smoke began rolling over the horizon. Fire trucks are starting to rip by and frantic men began yelling, "There's a fire on the Great Plain. We need help. Please, anybody come help." Frances Hammerstrom, if you're familiar with her work and her books, she's not a squeamish person and she does not suffer squeamishness lightly. And reflecting back to her 8-year-old self years later in one of her memoirs, she describes it. She says, "I vividly remember the very first time in my life where my courage failed me." So everybody was running up and said, "We need your help." And she went silent and stayed there. A lot of birds were lost in that fire. All of the nests for that year were gone. And according to Fran, they never recovered. So from 2,000 birds in 1916, in 1970, 1 year later, 175. By 1924, there was barely 50. 1927, 13. And in 1929, there was one left. That's 16 years later. There's a word for the very last individual of a species on a planet, and it might be one of the saddest words in conservation. It's called an endling. And so this last bird, this endling of the heath hen, was affectionately named Booming Ben, which is no relation to me. But now booming is the sound that a male prairie chicken makes when they're on their leks or their breeding grounds. And there's a strange irony in this name, because without any females to attract and there's no other males to compete, Booming Ben showed up every day to that lek and he was silent. Didn't say a thing. In 1931, he was affixed with some leg bands. And then in 1932, there was no trace of him left. He had vanished. And it's an important moment in conservation history, because this might be the first time we as a world watched a wild population go extinct just right in front of us. The last of the Carolina parakeets and passenger pigeons died in captivity, ironically, in the same cage. But, you know, this is probably less due to fire. There's some losses due to fire for sure, but it's less about fire and more about just the available habitat and conservation issues that we face when habitat becomes so tight. For example, a lot of energy is pumped into keeping disjunct populations of prairie chickens barely above water in Illinois and the Atwater prairie chicken along the Gulf Coast of Texas. And those populations are also, in a sense, islands. They inhabit fire-prone ecosystems. Back to the map. And fire is an important management activity for the maintenance of those habitats. But to illustrate how fragile this is, if you drop the footprint of the almost million-acre Dixie Fire from back in 2022 over the prairies near Victoria, Texas, or over Jasper and Marion County in Illinois, and it would fit. I checked. It would all be over for them. It's gone. And so it just illustrates the importance of how do we connect our populations? How do we make sure that we have that habitat out there on the land?
And fire is the major ingredient to keeping that habitat on the landscape that can serve as the connector. Great story.
Yeah, and maintained. Yeah.
All right, so let's move to closing thoughts here as we wrap up. And Maura, thank you very much for giving us so much time today and telling us about your research and your book. Ben, we'll start with you, and we'll let Maura have the mic drop closing comment for us today. So closing thoughts, Ben.
I think we've got a lot of work to do. I think about the areas in Nebraska and the areas in the Great Plains where we're doing really, really good work. And there's still, even with that good work that we're doing, there's very few places where we're at scale, where we still have a lot of work to go. We still have a lot of places to do. There's still a lot more fire that's needed, needed to catch up. And it's going to take a civilian army. I think about, we've mentioned California quite a bit during this, and California has the largest fire agency in the world, and even they cannot catch up. It's going to take everybody in our communities, the people bringing the muffins, the people that are filling up our vehicles, the people that are our farmers, our ranchers, everybody coming together to help this out. I think about back to just handing this back over to our private landowners, and we help them get started as conservation professionals, but we really need to make sure that we're giving it back to them and becoming their own heroes of their conservation story. And it reminds me of Herbert Stoddard. And if you've ever wondered about where the term prescribed fire came from, I think it's fascinating. Maura brought up the story a little bit with just the publication of this Bob White book and the Forest Service being an angst that we would actually encourage people, just the common citizen, to put fire on the ground. And he called it controlled burns, to put controlled burns on the ground, letting people do that. They didn't want that. And so they went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth for a while. And finally, they settled on a truce where they could call it prescribed fire. So it sounded like we had at least had experts prescribing it. Mm-hmm. That's where we're not talking about pharmaceuticals. This is where mm-hmm. that came from. And so taking that into thought now, where how do we turn this back over to those private landowners, to those communities, letting them do these things on their own, helping them feel competent and confident that they can do it. The Loop Treks that we run here, it's a 2-week event. It's in late March. We're doing big fires because at this point, our local landowners aren't doing it, but they're getting there. And at some point, our event focused on large fires is no longer going to be additive. And at that point, we'll probably pull the plug on it. I believe in our people. I think we're going to get there. It may take some time. But yeah, letting them be their own heroes and eventually pulling our logo away from the good work they're doing.
Yeah, it's a matter of scale. No matter what biologist, you know, from our perspective, what bird you're talking about, quail, sharpies, pheasants, every biologist will tell you the number one tool is controlled burning, prescribed burning. It's fire. Fire is rebirth for an ecosystem, particularly for the prairies, for the savannas. The habitat homes that our birds depend upon require fire. So really well said, Ben. Maura, I'll point people to the book. It's on sale right now on Amazon, $20.35. Ignition. If you find it and you're confused, it lists M.R. O'Connor as the author, but that's Maura. So it is on sale now. It's available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you find books. Thank you very much for being a part of the conversation, Maura. What do you want to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been really, really fun and super great to be talking with two people who are like so knowledgeable. So I guess, you know, for me, the book and the sort of like journey I've been on the last 4 years in learning about fire is, you know, stemmed out of my interest in science and conservation and climate change, a few of those types of subjects. But I think what I, over that period of time, started realizing is like the coolest thing about fire is that it's a story about people and about community. And so the people that I met and engaged with in the course of reporting the book, which includes Ben and the crews that he assembles every spring, you know, those people are really what this book was about. And I think what's so cool about that is that they really come from all over. Like, there's no one type. I had this image of like a wildland firefighter being like this sort of like bearded, grizzled dude, you know, chewing dip. And that actually is absolutely true in some cases. Those people exist. And I met quite a few of them. But there's so many other types. Mm-hmm. And like one of my favorite experiences in Nebraska is like burning with kids and burning with people in their 60s and just like everyone in between. You know, I've burned with people from all over the world. I've burned with like conservatives and liberals and, you know, hippies and veterans. And I'm not trying to make it seem like, you know, it's all sort of utopic and there's no issues. But my point is that fire has a way of bringing people together. And I think that's just such a remarkable thing in this day and age. And that's really the story that I hope to tell. And for people who live in Nebraska, it's just really cool that that's happening in their own backyard. And there's that kind of community being built there. And so, yeah, I hope people, you know, get as much joy about reading about that community as I did. It's just like sort of dipping my toe into it and getting to experience a little bit.
Yeah, right on. It is amazing whether it's amazing, but it's so simple. Fire brings people together. You know, campfires do that. Bonfires do that.
Cooking.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
Prescribed fires can do that as well around a very important mission, and that can be wildlife habitat conservation and keeping our prairies actually grasslands. So thank you very much. The book is Ignition, Lighting Fires in a Burning World by M.R., we call her Maura, O'Connor. Thank you very much, both of you, for sharing your knowledge about prescribed burning and the importance it plays in our wildlife habitat conservation mission. I'm Bob St. Pierre reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will arise. Thanks, folks.